My castaway this week is an umpire. The game of cricket has absorbed his whole life, from his childhood in Barnsley through his years as a professional batsman to his time as the embodiment of justice on the field of play. In 65 test matches, 92 one-day internationals and 3 World Cup finals, he's kept his temper and his judgment, despite confrontations with streakers, angry spectators or overexcited players. A tribute which particularly pleases him came from Ian Botham, who once said that he was the best umpire that had ever lived. Fair, honest, consistent and bonkers. He is Harold Dickey Bird. Bonkers and balmy are adjectives that... Why do they all say this about you, Dickey?
I've always been of a very highly strung nature. Mannerisms I do on the field I don't realise I'm doing. And I think this is where they all get this bonkers from.
But it's, I mean, obviously you have made the players laugh. I mean, you've had some, they've played a lot of practical jokes on you in your time, haven't they?
They were always taking the mickey out of me on the middle. And I miss Alan Lamb and Ian Botham out there because not only were they good players, they were characters. In a test match at Trent Bridge, Alan Lamb came out to bat for England at number 4. England had lost 2 quick wickets. And I was at square leg. And the pitch was over there, away from me, and Lamb came from the pavilion, and he's coming towards me at square leg, and I thought to myself, what's he doing coming towards me? Has his eyes gone? Or have my eyes gone? And he came up to me, he said, Dickey, I said, what's your problem? He said, I forgot. My mobile phone's in my pocket. He said, I forgot to take it out of my pocket. I want you to look after it, and if it rings, answer it. I said, you must be joking. We're in the middle of a test match, man. He said, put it in your pocket. If it rings, answer it. And off he wobbled away to take guard off my fella umpire. And the test match is going on and Lamb is playing away. And after about 6 or 7 overs, the phone rings in my pocket. I said, oh, no. I said, Lamb, it phone's ringing. He said, well, answer it, man. I said, we're in the middle of a test match, man. He said, answer it. So I pulled it out of my pocket. I said, hello, who's there? This is Ian Botham ringing from the dressing room. Tell that fella Lamb to play a few shots and get out. I said, Lamb, you have to play a few shots and get out. But, you know,
but Sue, that's very relaxed, Dickie. Well, I mean, can you afford to be that and at the same time command their respect?
Well, I think so, yes. I think you've got to smile. You've got to have a joke on the field. It helps to break the tension. That's what sport's all about. I like to think that I've always had the respect of every professional cricketer throughout the world, throughout the cricketing world.
Tell me about your first record for this desert island.
Oh, it's Nat King Cole, When I Fall in Love.
Why?
I don't know. It might bring back some happy memories to my youth and my love life. So, but I think Nat King Cole is a tremendous artist, great professional.
And the moment I can feel that, you feel that way too, is when I fall in love with you.
Nat King Cole and When I Fall in Love. How old were you when you fell in love with cricket, Dickie?
When I was at school. In those days, we played football and cricket at school. That's when it all started.
This was Barnsley in the 1930s.
Barnsley, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
30s. And then during the war?
And then up to when I left school in 1948.
But were you captain of the school teams and things?
Yeah, I captained the school team at football, and I captained the school team at cricket, and I went to Burton Rope Primary School, then to Rayleigh Secondary Modern School, and at Burton Rope Primary School and Rayleigh Secondary Modern School, my close friend was Tommy Taylor, who went on to play for Manchester United and England, who lost his life at Munich in the 1958 air disaster. And we were very, very close friends, and we used to practice for hours together. And it's amazing, you know, Sue, Tommy's father and my father worked at the same coal face down the mines. So did Michael Parkinson's father. He worked at another local colliery, and Geoffrey Boycott's father. But when you think, the names I've just mentioned, we were all kids, and all our fathers worked down the same, more or less the same coal mines, And it's amazing. I think we had a good upbringing. My mum and dad always made sure that I went to church. They were always Whatever we wanted, a good table, food was good.
But did you have all the equipment to play on? I mean, did you have proper bats and balls
and things like that?
On?
No, that's a good point, Sue. We didn't. We used to have to make our own cricket bats in those days from old pieces of wood and with tin round it and everything, and our footballs were stuffed with old rags and things like that. But I think it helped us to succeed in later years. It gave us this will to succeed in our chosen professions. When I left school, I went to Barnsley Cricket Club as a 15-year-old. Boy at Barnsley Cricket Club.
But your teachers told you that you were only any good at sport, didn't
they?
Well,
that's right. My report sheets were good advice for Dickie. Tell him to stick to sport.
But your dad was a miner, as you said, but yeah. He wouldn't have wanted you to go down the pit, I presume.
No, that is correct. My father wanted me to play sport. He said it was a clean living and a good living. And he encouraged me as a youngster to play sports. So.
And did he live to see you get to the top as an umpire?
He lived to see me play at county cricket, Sue, but he never saw me umpire. I was very sad about that because I would have loved now, Sue, to give him things that he never had in life, you know what I mean? And he never saw me umpire. And I remember going to hospital to visit him, Sue, in June 1969. He was in hospital and I said to him, Dad, I'm thinking about becoming a first-class cricket umpire. And he looked at me and said, well, whatever you do, son, I wish you the best. And he died the next day. So he never saw me umpire, which was very sad, so.
Tell me about your second record.
My second record is Abide With Me. My mum and dad always made me go to church. My father made me join the YMCA as a young man. He was a member as well, the YMCA, the Young Men's Christian Association. I've always gone to church, Sue. I still go to church. And I think that early upbringing by my parents making me go to church has certainly helped me throughout my career. And that's the reason I've chose Abide With Me.
Abide With Me, sung by the choir of King's College, Cambridge. So sport was the great escape in Barnsley, Yorkshire. You and Parkey were opening batsmen in post-war Barnsley, weren't you?
That's right, Sue. When I left school in 1948, I went to Barnsley Cricket Club and I opened the innings there with Michael Parkinson. And we had a young lad called Geoffrey Boycott who batted in that side at number six. But, of course, he was still at school. He was at Emsworth Grammar School.
But did you spot then that he was a star?
No, I didn't. I'll be honest with you. I thought he would make himself into probably an average county cricketer. But he had this will, this determination, this concentration, this belief that he had in himself. And I remember him saying to me, he was only 16. No one had heard of Geoffrey Boycott. He hadn't even been to the Yorkshire Nets, I don't think. And he said to me, Dickie, he said, by the time I am 24, I shall have the Three Lions of England on my chest and I shall be opening for England. And he did it.
And he's treated you to a few sumptuous dinners in your time, hasn't he?
Not really. I can't get into his place, so. I live about a mile and a half from him and he's got his walls about 10 feet high round his gardens and it's impossible for... And he invited me to come one day to have lunch with him and all his gates were locked and he's got all these electronic devices, you see. I pressed this button, this voice said, hello. He said, who's there? I said, Dickie Bird, come to have lunch with you, Geoffrey. Can't enter. I said, what? You've just invited me. I'm sorry, can't enter. I thought, oh dear. So I climbed up his wall and then I jumped and I managed to grab a branch of a tree and lower myself into his ground. And then I went up and knocked on his door. He said, how do you get in here? I said, Geoffrey, you've invited me and I've got in. He said, well, you better come in now. And he said, we'll have some lunch in a minute. So I sat down and I thought, well, we'll have some roast beef and Yorkshire puddings. And he said, we'll have lunch now. And he said, what's this? And she said, well, it's a toasted cheese sandwich. Hope you enjoy it. Eat it quickly. And he said, when you go back, he said, I don't want you stopping here long. Make sure that you walk down the pathway. I don't want you walking on my lawns, he said.
But is he serious?
Do you know, Sue, when we were in the World Cup in 1986-87, he said to me, we'll have dinner together tonight, Dickie. I said, marvellous, Geoffrey. He said, I'll meet you in the foyer of the Taj Palace in Delhi. So I arrived and he came. And we went to the shop, the little shop in the foyer. And he went in, he said, a bar of Cadbury's fruit and nut chocolate. I thought, what's he doing? And he came out and he snapped it in half. He said, that's half for you and half for me. He said, that's your dinner.
It's unbelievable. He's just trying to live up to his reputation.
I'll tell you this, and I've told him. I said, you can't take your money with you, boys, but he will. He'll get it in that coffin when they bury him, Sue. And I've told him I hope I'm still around because I dig it up.
Let's have some more music. Number three, what's that?
Oh, Barbara Streisand and The Way We Were. That's another great professional artist. I don't know whether you... Did you know Vic Lewis, Sue? He was a man... He's a big cricket fanatic. He's always at Lord's. And he was a man who used to handle all the great artists when they came to England. He used to look after them. Some kind, like an agent. And I remember I said to him once, I said, Vic, of all the great artists that you've handled when they come to England, who would you say is the best you've ever seen? He said, Dickie, there's only been two. He said, Nat King Cole and Barbara Streisand.
Memories light the corners of my mind. Misty watercolor memories of the way we were.
Barbara Streisand and The Way We Were. So, Dickie Bird, you signed for Yorkshire in 1952, age 19, Yorkshire Colts. How would you rate yourself as a player?
I thought I was a good county cricketer, no more than a good county cricketer, Sue. And when I was at Yorkshire, we had such a great side in those days. We kept winning the championship every year. It was a tremendous side. I'm talking about players like Freddie Trueman, Brian Close, Raymond Illingworth, Don Wilson, Ken Taylor, Brian Stott, Dougie Patch. It was a tremendous side, and it was difficult to get a regular place in the side.
You never did get one, did you?
No, I didn't. So I once scored 181 not out for Yorkshire on a bat pitch at Bradford Park Avenue against Glamorgan, who had some very, very good spin bowlers. And I thought to myself, well, surely they'll select me for the next couple of matches. And I came off the field and I was taking my pads off in the dressing room and my gloves. And the Yorkshire chairman in those days, it was Brian Sellers, and he came into the dressing room, he said, well played, Birdie. That's played well there, but get the head down. We've dropped thee into the second team, he said. So they dropped me. I said, thank you very much, Mr. Sellers. But, you know, in those days, it took 39 of them to drop me because there was 39 on the selection committee.
But you did stay for a long time, did you? Yeah. About 8 years or so?
A lot of people thought I left Yorkshire then, but I didn't, so I kept playing in and out of the side.
But eventually you went to Leicestershire.
Eventually I went to Leicestershire.
And you've said since that it was like batting in a graveyard.
Well, Leicestershire were bottom of the county championship table. To play in a struggling side, Sue, it's very, very hard work. And people were looking on to me, coming from Yorkshire, you know what I mean. And I didn't have a lot of success at Leicestershire.
You must have been very miserable.
I was. Yes, I was. Miserable and down.
How long did you stick it?
I was stuck it there for about 6 years.
So you were never to make it to the top as a player.
That's
when did
right.
it dawn on you that there was another way of getting onto those test pitches by becoming an umpire?
Well, in 1969, I was watching Yorkshire play at Headingley, and some of the Yorkshire players came to me and said, have you ever thought of becoming an umpire? A first-class cricket umpire, because that is when you've played first-class cricket all your life, umpiring is probably the next best thing to play in the game. So I said, what umpire? I just laughed at them. I said, you must be joking. And I left Headingley and I thought there might be something in that, Sue. So I wrote to Lord's to apply for the first-class county umpires list and I was accepted in November 1969. And I did my first match in 1970 on the county list, and that's how it all started.
And the rest is a 27-year history, and you've seen them all off.
I've seen them all. So it's unbelievable. When you think of Dennis Lilly, Greg Chappell, Ian Chappell, Rodney Marsh, Clive Lloyd, Sunil Gavaskar, Geoffrey Boycott, Ian Botham, David Gower, Graham Gooch, Michael Olding, Andy Roberts. I can go on and on and on. I saw them all start as young men on the Test match scene. They've all retired, all finished, and I'm still umpiring Test matches.
Record number four.
Oh, record number four, Sue. The Band of the Grenadier Guards. You know, I always like a quick march, and when they do have the bands at Lord's occasionally, when you walk down those steps at Lord's, through the members' long room and down the steps, and you hear the bands playing, oh, it gives you a tremendous thrill, you know.
Grenadier Guards playing the Radetzky March. So, Dickie, you umpired your first-class match in 1970 at the Oval, and apparently you arrived very early, as you do. How early and what happened?
I remember it was my first match, and I travelled down from Yorkshire on the Friday, and I thought, well, I'll get in easily to one of the hotels in London. But I didn't realise it was the Rugby League Cup final, and I couldn't get in to any hotel in London. They were awful. And eventually I got into a small hotel in Swiss Cottage. And I thought, good God, that's a good way from the Oval. I've got to get across the river. And so I said to the night porter, I'd like a call for 4:30, 4:30, please. He said, what? He said, where are you going? I said, I've got to get to the Oval. He said, what time's the start? I said, 11 o'clock. He said, you must be joking. I said, cup of tea, that's all I want. A little bit of toast, 4:30. So I got up at 4:30. And had me toast and everything. And, of course, I went straight through London, no trouble. When I arrived at the Oval at 6 o'clock in the morning for a... I think it was 11:30 start in those days, 1970. I thought, oh, I'm a bit early here. And I couldn't get into the ground because all the gates were locked, of course. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? I thought, I'll try and climb over the gates at the Oval. They were all locked. So I threw my bag over the gates and started climbing over the gates. And I just got to the top and I heard this London bobby. I said, now then, what do you think you're doing up there? I said, well, officer, to tell you the truth, I know you're not going to believe me, but my ball's gone over the wall. He said, you come down here. So when I explained to him who I was and everything, and I showed him my pass to get into the ground, and I was officiating Surrey v Yorkshire starting at 11:30 today, he said, I've seen it all, he said, and I've heard it all. And we sat there and had a good laugh together. I think he stayed with me for about an hour just nattering away till the ground staff arrived to open the gate so I could get in.
But you've arrived early at Downing Street for drinks with Mrs. Thatcher. You've arrived early at Chequers for lunch with John Major. You've arrived early at Buckingham Palace for lunch with the Queen.
That's right.
I mean, why? It's very embarrassing, isn't
well,
it?
When I was invited to have lunch with the Queen, Sue, that was... because I am a royalist, and that was the best day of my life, so a day I shall always remember for as long as I live. I had to be at Buckingham Palace for 1:45, so I thought, 1:45, I've got to get there early. So I left home at 5 o'clock in the morning to catch the 6:02 train from Wakefield. And when I got onto the platform, just as the train, I got on the platform, the train was pulling in the 6:02 train. My tickets to get into Buckingham Palace. Oh, no, I've left them. The guard said, what's your problem? He recognised me, Dickie. I said, my tickets. I've left them in the car. And the engine driver, the train driver, said, well, I'm sorry, Dickie, he recognised me. I've got to go. Oh, I said, come on, mate, please. Let me just go get my tickets. He said, for you, Dickie. I'll hold the train up, he said. But I wouldn't hold the train up for the mate boycott, he said. But for you, yes. And do you know, Sue, I arrived at Buckingham Palace at 8:45. I thought, oh, dear, I'm a bit early. So the police recognised me and said, "What are you doing, Dickie? Are you sightseeing? It's not cricket season," because it was November. I said, "No, I've been invited to have lunch with the Queen." So I showed them my pass. They said, "What, 1:15? It's only 8:40. I said, "Oh, I know a little coffee shop round corner from Buckingham Palace. I'll go and sit there." So I went round in the little coffee shop and I sat there for 4 hours. And I came back and they said, "Well, we've got to have the changing of the guards. Yeah, Dickie, we can't stop that for Dickie Bird." Oh, I said, "Oh, dear." So I waited till they had the changing of the guards and said, "Right, you can go through now." And I went through, so, and it was the best day of my life. That.
Next record.
Oh, Land of Hope and Glory. Now, as I said to you, Sue, I am a royalist, and I always remember, if I may tell you this, in 1977, the Queen's Silver Jubilee year, England were playing Australia at Lord's, and the two teams and the umpires, we were invited to Clarence House to have drinks with the Queen Mother. And when I was introduced to the Queen Mother, she said to me, "Dickie?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." She said, "You haven't been wearing your white cap at Lord's today." I said, "No, I haven't, because it was overcast, ma'am." She said, "I know." She said, "I always know it's you, with all your mannerisms, when your elbow, you're twisting your arms and you've got your white cap." She said, "I always know it's you." And it's things like that, so money can't buy.
Part of Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance, March No. 1, Land of Hope and Glory, played by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by André Previn. What do you keep in the pockets of your little white coat, Dickie?
Oh, dear, Sue, I keep everything in there. Chewing gum. The players are always asking me for chewing gum. I keep saying to them, "It's about time you bought your own chewing gum."
But it costs you a bit.
That's what I say. My little counters, which are miniature red barrels, a penknife, a spare rag in case the ball gets wet, a spare cricket ball, spare bail, scissors, they come in handy, scissors. I always remember in a test match at Old Trafford, Sunil Gavaskar, the great Indian opening batsman, was batting. Then when he got to the non-striker's end, he said, "Dickie," he said, "have you any scissors?" I said, "Yes, I have." I said, "What do you want them for?" He said, "My fringe is coming down over my eye, so the scissors came in handy. I just..." Clipped the front of his hair off. He said, "Thank you very much." So the scissors come in handy for that. Lastoplast, in case someone grazes their arm or hand or anything. Oh, so many things. That go on and on, Sue.
Needle and cotton.
Needle and cotton, yeah.
Running repairs.
Running
done.
Repairs, that's right. Everything.
You always look very worried out on the field. I mean, you are very familiar to us all with all those sweaters tied round your waist and so on. And then suddenly, you know, you leave your spot if there's a kind of dubious catch and you rush across to talk to the fielder who's claiming he's caught somebody. What are you saying to him in that moment?
Well, there's times, especially with a catch on the boundary, when the umpire is 90 yards away, it's very, very difficult to see if the fielder has caught it clearly. He may have stepped over the line, he may have just touched the line. So if there's any doubt, I go to the fielder, I run all the 90 yards, and I go to him and I eyeball him eye to eye, and I said to him, "I am a churchgoer, I go to church. I want you to be honest with me, young man. Did you catch that fairly and cleanly? Because the good Lord is watching us. I want you to be honest." Works, so I get them the shaking like this.
And what about when you know, there's bad language? Do you use the same kind of technique?
I remember in a test match at Headingley, Mervyn Hughes, who has now retired from test match cricket, he was a tremendous character, a great competitor on the field. And I remember he was bawling to Grahamick at Headingley, and he was swearing at Grahamick. So I said to him, "Merv, I don't want you swearing at that man. Grahamick, he's done you no harm. Why are you swearing at him?" I don't want you swearing at him. And he walked past me to bowl the next ball in Merv. He looked at me and he said, Dickie Bird, you're a legend.
Let's have some more music.
Record number 6, so Julio Iglesias singing Feelings with Pam Bunning. I don't know if she is Pam Bunning. It's a mystery to us all, that.
For all my life I feel I wish I never met you, babe. You'll never come again.
Feelings, sung by Julio Iglesias with, you're quite right, Dickie, Pam Bunning. There's an increasing use of the third umpire these days, the television set in the pavilion, ready to show an action replay to the umpire in there. Do you approve, Dickie, of these kind of electronic aids?
I think the electronic aid is a tremendous help to the umpire for the close run-outs and the close stumpings.
Because it's going to show something from an angle that you can't necessarily
correct.
See.
That's a good point. That is correct. And so it is tremendous for those close decisions. But I would not like to see come in for LBW decisions, the bat pad decisions, the court behind decisions, because I feel sure electronic cannot help you with that.
Because again, it isn't in the right position and you are.
Correct. Presumably. LBWs, the cameras are too high for a start, and also you have so many things to take into consideration. Where the ball is bought from, as I said earlier, how much it's done on the seam and everything. And for the court behinds, you hear all sorts of noises stood there as the umpire. And the bat pads, which is very difficult. I cannot see what electronic aid can help you with that.
But there's something more than that, isn't there? I mean, in a sense, controversy. I mean, the whole business of people appealing, how's that? It's all part of the game somehow, isn't it? And it's rather sad to try and make it perfect. Its imperfections are part of its charm, aren't they?
I think with the vast amount of money, winning now means everything. And winning is not everything in life. To win, we all like to win, don't get me wrong, Sue. But sport's to be enjoyed. And once you lose that enjoyment, Sue, you're lost, you might as well pack it up.
England has been having a terrible time for a long time now. What's the problem, Dickie?
I think that we're playing too much cricket. I think we're playing too many one-day international matches. I think that the lads are stale at the moment, I do honestly. And now I know what you're going to say, it's more than that. I think, Sue, that we've got some good young cricketers in England now. I think we've got some good young players. And I think these young players, Sue, have got to be given their chance. I do, honestly. What is there to lose now? Might as well throw them in.
Record number 7.
Record number 7, Shirley Bassey singing Till.
Why do you want that?
She's a tremendous professional, anyway, I'll say that. But then again, it brings back so happy memories of my early youth, my love life, and I was in, when I was a young man.
And it still makes you cry, by the way.
I still get a lump in my throat, yeah. But the artists I've got here are tremendous, great professionals.
Till the moon deserts the sky, till all the seas run dry, till then I'll worship you.
Shirley Bassey and Till, bringing back memories for you, Dickie, of your love life. You keep mentioning this love life. You've never married.
I never married. So I came close to marriage when I was younger on two occasions. And I never married. The reason, I'll give you the reason. I signed for Yorkshire when I was 19, Sue, so I've lived out of a suitcase all my life. And I don't think I could have been fair to a woman, Sue, because I'd be worrying, what is she doing? She would be worrying, what am I doing? I never married, but if I've missed something in life, I've missed having a family. That's one thing I've missed, love. If I could have had a lad, if he'd have played local cricket, it would have given me so much pleasure, and that's one thing that I've missed in life. Not having a family.
So what will happen after June when you umpire your last test, your 66th, and then
You know, you spent all these years being footloose and fancy-free, but now you don't have to go out of the house if you don't want
to. Well, the thing is, Sue, is that I'm finishing at international level this summer. I should be 63, and then I have one season left, which I shall umpire on the county circuit after that. And then I'm 65, so then we have to go anyway. That's the law of the Test and County Cricket Board. But I do hope that I have health and strength at 65, because I still would like to be involved with cricket, because if I go and sit in my 17th century cottage at home, Sue, sit in that chair at 65 years of age and start worrying and thinking about everything and inventing things to worry about, which I do, I won't live 12 months after that, and I mean that. I shall go all over the world watching cricket, because cricket's been my life. I've been married to cricket, as you say. And I just hope I have some good health.
Can you imagine how you will feel on June the 20th, your last appearance at international level at Lord's, when you walk down that long room you've described and out and down the steps?
I've got a lump in my throat now, Sue. When I walk down those steps, through the members and that long room at Lord's, because Lord's is something special to me, Sue. It's been my second home throughout my career. And when I walk through the long room, through the members, down the members' enclosure, onto the green at Lord's, out to the middle, I've a tear in my eye now, so I shall shed a few tears. That test match will tell you that now. I hope that I don't make many bad decisions for crying, that I'll be able to see all right for the tears. But that will be something special, very special in my life, that last test match.
Tell me about your last record.
My last record, Sue, is Pavarotti singing Ness and Dormer. I've chosen that is because when I was in Barbados, Sue, on holiday, I was swimming in the sea and I bumped into this. I thought I bumped into a whale in the sea, and I looked up and I couldn't believe it. It was Pavarotti. And that's why I've chosen this.
Luciano Pavarotti singing Nessun Dorma from Puccini's Turandot with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Kurt Adler. If you could only take one of those records, Dickie, instead of all eight, I wonder which one you'd take.
Oh, it's a difficult one, that, Sue. I think I'd go for Barbara Streisand, The Way We Were. If I had to pick, very difficult.
What about your book? Because the Bible's there already on the island, and the complete works of Shakespeare.
Yeah, it was difficult, but I chose the Wisden Annual because... as I say, I'm a cricket fanatic, and in the Wisden Annual, there's everything in there, everything.
And what about your luxury?
My luxury would be a television set, a satellite dish, so that I can watch all the test matches.
Dickie Bird, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
I've enjoyed it, Sue. Tremendous honour to be on this programme.